Warren Trolfing on behalf of Lori Wellington. This is another Social Security case involving an onset date issue, except it's the same impairment that rolls back in time. It's not a different impairment. The administrative law judge accepted the report of Dr. Cushman. Dr. Cushman describes a woman that's in front of him who has a history of sexual abuse as a child. She was repeatedly molested by her uncle, who died when she was 12, and it stopped. She was abused by her stepfather. She was abused verbally, at least verbally, by her husband, who she was married to for 10 years. And Dr. Cushman has this woman in front of him, does a complete mental status examination, with positive findings, and says that she has, as a result of her medical history, sexual abuse as a child, physical and sexual abuse as an adult, post-traumatic stress disorder. She was robbed at gunpoint while working in a store. She has a panic disorder associated with psychological factors, and she has a dependent personality disorder. She has a drug history that's in complete remission by this point. And Dr. Cushman describes significant impairments in the ability to perform work activity, like tolerating the ordinary stress of work day, showing up on time. Things that the judge agrees, these destroy the ability to engage in substantial gainful activity. The commissioner argues, well, Ms. Wellington actually got worse after Dr. Cushman sees Ms. Wellington in May of 2011, because she got recontacted by her ex-husband, and she had that forever dizzy, and then her father dies, and that aggravates her mental condition. The important thing to remember is that the judge, the ALJ, did not assign an onset date based on any of this discrete trauma. He found that the woman that Dr. Cushman examined was in fact disabled. She didn't become disabled when she walked through the door. She was disabled before she got in the door. At the end of the insured period in 2008 and into 2009, we have numerous emergency room visits that describe her either primarily, secondary, or tertiarily as having anxiety disorder. It's discernible and obvious to a trained mental health professional, but to an emergency room physician. And the question is, does Dr. Cushman's stake in the sand cast a shadow back in time that a medical expert or some other person could establish an onset date? The commissioner argues that it's clear that Dr. Cushman described a woman as disabled on that day. I agree. So it's clear that she was disabled before she walked in the door. This is the case where the impairment that is frankly disabling has a long and chronic history and casts a shadow back in time, and it's exactly the kind of case that 8320, Armstrong, and other cases that from this court have described as requiring the input from a medical expert to tell us when, whether it's January of 2011, so she gets another 4 months of SSI, or December 31st, 2008, when she's in this hospitalization sequence where she's going repeatedly to the emergency room. So she gets some disability insurance benefits, and she gets Medicare instead of Medi-Cal.
Maybe you can help me with this, because I'm totally familiar with it. So let's say that we agree with your position that a medical expert were to be appointed. How exactly does being a trained medical professional go about? You have the person in front of you, you have the records, and we've got them, I assume. We have a lot of emergency room visits, hospitalizations, like
you see, so just look at those dates. That's the date. I mean, that's what I'm just curious about. What can a medical expert do to help with this problem?
Well, there are several factors. One is the mental status examination that we have from Dr. Cushman. And we have the history of trauma as a child and as an adult. And we have the history of emergency room treatment, where there's clearly psychological factors that are pushing this woman into the emergency room with pain complaints because she's, I don't pretend to be a doctor either, but she's having physical manifestations of her psychic problems. And it's up to a medical expert to look at that and say, the person that Dr. Cushman is describing, that condition had a pre-diagnostic, pre-morbid phase that extends back.
Well, yeah, don't get me wrong. You're absolutely right. I don't think that it was the examination. I thought it was in May of 2010. That's why I'm
just... I'm sorry. I misspoke.
That could not have suddenly rendered her disabled. I mean, clearly this had been building for a while, but I look at these records and thankfully, I'm not called information, but I wouldn't be able to say, you know, well, it's not, you know, it's not even January of 2010, it's not January of 2011, it's this date right here. Because, I mean, you know, some of the physical complaints that your client had, like the palpitations and stuff, they run the test, and they're like, man, your phone came to your home, these are all normal. We can see that you're suffering in some kind of outward way, but we've run our test, and we can't find anything wrong with you. Just go ahead, you know, right?
Well, one of the factors that plays into this is we have the presidential case of Quinn versus Chandler, where we don't penalize people for having a lack of sophistication to go after mental health treatment when we as professionals look at them and say, this woman didn't use the mental health treatment for years. Well, why weren't you in treatment? We don't penalize her for making that poor decision. That's just a double hit on top of the trauma of her life. But trained mental health, the analogy is that we look at a case and because of our experiences as lawyers and as judges, we know we can start to discern it before we turn the page what happened and why and what the index factor is going to be. And we're right 90% of the time because of our experience. It's the same thing with a mental health professional. This is why when Congress passed the Disability Reform Act of 1984, they required that mental health professionals be involved at the initial reconsideration stages of disability determinations, because we as lay people lack the professional insight to see Dr. Cushman's report and the history and these other medical records in the background and to either interpolate or extrapolate whichever geometric progression is necessary. Correct, medically reasonable honesty, not to a medical certainty, but to a medical probability. And I would urge this so that we can have that medical professional. This is why we didn't ask for a reversal for the payment of benefits. This requires a medical professional that the agency has described as required under these circumstances.
Okay, why don't we hear from them?
Yes.
Give you a chance to respond.
Good morning, Your Honor. It's Elizabeth Fear for the Acting Commissioner of Social Security. SSI 8320 does not require some kind of magical assumption of when a disability started. Someone is always disabled one day and then weren't disabled the next. It's a legal conclusion, not an emotional one. And what that SSI requires is that the onset date have a legitimate medical basis. What we have here. Well, Mr. Rolfe is talking about all these things that happened to his client early on, but she worked until 1 week before she was alleging she before her the last insured. So,
but you go through, I mean, it's like this when she was fired, I guess, the day before Christmas in 2008, right?
So, I don't think she was fired. There's nothing in the record that says she was fired, so she stopped working.
Well, I thought that she hadn't been showing up for work because she kept going.
Well, she didn't. That doesn't mean she was fired. She stopped working.
It's like you just finished my sentence. All I was saying is that she was, I thought,
that's who she was.
Let me start over again, okay?
I'm sorry.
Okay, I'm as close to the microphone as I can get, is that? Okay, the acoustics are bad in this room. I'm wanting you to help me if I'm getting something wrong in the record. I thought the record was that in December of 2008, she had a whole series of emergency room visits, maybe even one hospitalization. And that caused her to have to take off time from her job, right? And then finally her employer just said, look, this isn't working. Basically, you're not able to show up enough. And so her employment was terminated, whether she was fired or whether she just was just not able to return. I thought that happened in December, late December of 2008. So have I missed something there?
I think she did seek treatment for anxiety in December 2008, but I don't see anything in the record that says anything about what her employer said about that. I'm taking that as the date she stopped working. So, yes, she was complaining of anxiety around that time, but that's
okay.
Last month.
All right, so, but my only thought was that we do have some indication that she was suffering from severe enough, I think it's mostly anxiety or panic attacks, that it prevented her from continuing her employment.
whether she, maybe you're right, maybe she wasn't, you know, fired, but she wasn't not able to continue working, and that just seems, it's a pretty good indication, right, that this diagnosis that she got later in May of 2010, that wasn't the first point in time at which she, in fact, was not able to work.
Well, if someone's stopping work because of what they're saying, is are their symptoms, is it the same as under the Social Security Act, them being unable to work? People will always say, I stopped working because I couldn't, because of my medical condition, but that's not the legal conclusion that the Social Security Administration has to make. So let's, in 2008, she stops working. Then her day last insured is literally the end of 2008. So I think that there's, and then let's look what happened in 2009. Exhibit 2F is all about her treatment in 2009. And it's at Golden Valley. The only diagnosis is anxiety state unspecified. And then if you look at those treatment notes, none of them are consistent with any kind of extreme limitation or extreme kind of anxiety. They didn't even say, you need this kind of treatment. And in fact, in June, she specifically said she was looking for a job, a desk job, and her treater said she had reported no symptoms of sleep changes, anxiety, focusing, depression, moodiness, suicidal thoughts, or any kind of abnormal thoughts or feelings. That's in the middle of June, just in the middle of 2009. So she says at the first hearing that since December 2008, she has had panic attacks constantly every day. Well, then how come her treatment records all through 2009 fail to support that? So that's 2009. Then we get to 2010, and that I think just absolutely takes care of any day of application. So her day last insurance, and as this court has held, if you're trying to, if you apply for benefits after your day last insured, you have to prove a continuous disability from the time that you were still insured. So that's the end of 2008, and all of 2009, where there's very unremarkable findings. And I would say that even when she goes to emergency rooms for these anxiety situations or palpitations, I didn't see any one of them talking about how this is debilitating. And as the ALJ said in the decision, you would assume, given the severity of her allegations, that some doctor during that period would have said, hey, there's really something wrong with this woman. She should see a specialist. She shouldn't be working. She should be, you know, in some kind of serious treatment, given the severity of her allegations. So then in 2010, which is January 2010, is the absolute earliest back that she could be entitled to an onset based on this SSI application, because she applied at the end of December. Month after. So we're talking about 4 months, January, February, March, April of 2010. Let's look what happens in the beginning of 2010. She visits the hospital for neck pain and asthma, and they say she's positive for anxiety, but she gets morphine and her symptoms resolve completely. Unremarkable mental status findings. That's January 2010. Then you go to March 2010. Her self-report, she says she admits going out 3 times a week. She gets rides to go places. She shops. She engages in hobbies. She's,
I thought she said that since she stopped working back in 2008, she basically did not go out of the house for fear of...
That's not true. I'm sorry.
I want to hear your response. Believe me, I'm not sure. Those 9 years, I just want to get my whole sentence out. I thought she said that she would not go out of the house except to go shopping occasionally with her mother, but that was about the extent of what she could do because she was, you know, just pantry all the time. So that's, you're saying that's wrong.
Yeah, I'd say that that's absolutely not supported by the record.
Why is that what she said? So is there something that shows that, in fact, now she was out frolicking around?
Well, I guess part of what I would say is everything that I just reiterated about her treatment, and nobody says anything about why she's really out of it. She's always, you know, pretty much, even when she's anxious, she's still, you know, acute distress. They say things like that. But in March 2010, she can report that she goes out to church. She goes out three times a week. She didn't need to be accompanied when she went out. She said that in March 2010. So that already absolutely contradicts anything that she said about
this. Is it different also, though, he stands here, anxiety medicine prescribed, and if she took it, it appears that that served.
Yes, absolutely, yes. And she actually testified to that at the first hearing, too, that she'd have an attack and she takes Xanax and would resolve completely. So then we have Dr. Cushman in May 2010. His opinion provides the earliest possible onset date that's supported by medical evidence, and that's what the ALJ did. And why the agency talks about what happened to her after that is because there are two other state agency doctors who found subsequent to May 2010 that she actually was capable of working. So what the ALJ did by using Dr. Cushman's examination date as the onset is actually gives her a much more favorable onset date than could have. You know, in July 2010, Dr. Zukowski finds that the claimant's not disabled, and then subsequent to that, Dr. Garcia found that in September 2010. So that's why what happened after matters. What the ALJ did here was reasonable. He took this absolute earliest possible time that medical evidence supports a finding of disability. And he said, well, I don't agree with those state agency doctors because I see the treatment records and she finally starts treatment with with Mr. Thompson. And there's that 15F and 22F. He sees the social worker who was referred by Dr. Cohen, who starts reporting these very significant symptoms to him. And he also looks at that. That's August, or July, August, into December, and then 2011. And that her complaints and her symptoms are much different than they were prior to May 2010.
Okay, but let me ask you this, because then maybe I'm just too simplistic in my thinking, but I see somebody with her history, zero bond, just remember, and it goes back to childhood, it's just there's a lot of things that happened to her leading up to the May 2010 date, and it just seems impossible that she was, you know, magically rendered disabled as of that visit, and so that suggests to me right off the bat that there's probably some date going back, and you just don't know when exactly. So isn't that what the regulation says? Well, when it's ambiguous, you need some medical help to help you pinpoint that date.
Well, I think that's reading it too broadly. If that were the case, if every time, it's not a magical date. It has to be reasonably based on medical evidence here. So the ALJ did that. I think the ALJ did that. So claimants contesting it now. And in Armstrong, you said that once the ALJ has created a record that helps identify the onset date, the claimant wishes to tell them she needs proof that that was a wrong date. I mean, earlier when we were talking about what would a medical examiner do or a medical expert do here, what would it do? The record's already here. Two state agency experts looked at it subsequent to Dr. Cushman and found it still didn't support disability. So what would a medical expert do? Sit there and look at stuff and pick some random date that might have been different. It might also be after May 2010. So the SSR does not require an ALJ to get a medical expert anytime there's some kind of condition that doesn't warrant an absolute date-specific onset. What the regulation requires is the ALJ to support that with a legitimate medical basis, and we have that here. The case law doesn't interfere with that. Armstrong specifically says that once it's determined, the claimant has the burden to prove that it's wrong, and the claimant just hasn't done that here. All of that history didn't prevent her from working all the way up to December 2008. And all of and I would also just like to put it that certain doctors did look at her up to that point, and none of them said, as the ALJ said, none of them said she's disabled or she, you know, has all these disabling limitations. And the RFC that the ALJ says actually counts for a lot of that stuff up to
Let's take another run at it, because I'm a little bit slow on this development. But so I look at the records in December of 2008. And all of the hospital visits she makes, it's like almost every other day, it seems like she's going into the emergency room with these panic and anxiety attacks. And whether it's right or not, that is what led her to stop working, and she didn't work after that point. I guess I'm stuck on, well, why does that introduce ambiguity as to whether maybe actually she was disabled all the way back then? Maybe not, but maybe. And don't we need some medical expert to evaluate all that and help us?
Well, I would go back to what I said about what happened in 2009. In the middle of 2009, she's actually looking for work. And I would also, in asked you to really look at what those emergency room records say. She goes in, and you said it earlier, that there's nothing wrong with her. She's not hospitalized.
I said nothing. So did you physical test?
There's no question.
Wait. But there is nothing wrong with her. There's no question about that. I mean, a couple of points. I think she's hospitalized. She's released. They keep her multiple nights.
I only saw one where she was kept multiple nights. Yeah.
You get hospitalized, right? I mean, that's pretty serious. That's
important. And in the whole course of her life and the things that happened to her, going to it, and the one time when they did hospitalize her, I thought that was because they really were concerned about what the cardiac situation might have been, and it proved to be benign. But this woman, the fact that she kind of goes crazy and goes into an emergency room, she has panic attacks, and then is pretty much contained in a relatively good period of time, doesn't say anything about what her functional abilities are, what her, it conflicts with many other things she's done. And I really want, 2009, she's looking for work.
But all I'm saying is that maybe you're right, but isn't that, doesn't that raise questions? Isn't that sufficient to get you to where there's going to be any help?
I would say, no, it doesn't. I mean, in a sort of like intellectual way, it might, but based on what the ruling requires and what your case law requires, we're fine here. We have a legitimate medical basis for the onset date. And claiming sort of speculation and hope that maybe if you haven't looked at this and find an earlier onset date doesn't refute what the ALJ did here. And again, I would point out, given the evidence from the state agency after May 2010, there's a good chance a medical expert would look at this and say she really wasn't disabled until at least August or September 2010. So that's a big risk that I claim is taking in this case, too. I think the ALJ did the right thing here. He found the earliest possible date where there was medical evidence supporting disabling symptoms.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much for your answers. You're putting some time for rebuttal. You've got a lot to respond to, perhaps. No? Okay. According to one fell swoop. Lori Wellington is an individual who goes to see Dr. Cushman, who describes this panoply of impairments that we're all aware of. And he says, how are you doing? And she says, I'm all right. And Dr. Cushman records her response and says she giggles nervously. This is not a woman who's trying to feign disability or feign anxiety. She's trying to get through life. When you're down and out, when you're trying, when you have nothing left, you try to work. You try. You at least cognitively entertain the idea, if I could just get back to work, my life would be a whole other. And when we look at her earnings record, she has 1 year in the last 15 where she was engaged in what we call substantial gainful activity. The year that she stops working, she makes $5,200. She's not killing it. Her primary insurance amount, her benefit, is only $325 a month. She has never been a successful member of society in terms of her earnings. She's been scraping by, and now she's hit rock bottom. And she hit it when she went into the hospital in October, November, December, January, February, and March 2008-9. And I think that slays the dragon, I'm not sure.
Thank you very much. The case just argued will be submitted.